I'm Richard Harris, and welcome to Real Risk, the podcast that talks to people who put themselves in harm's way. You know the type. Big wave surfers, professional soldiers, base jumpers. I'll get inside the heads of men and women who seem fearless or even reckless. They might seem crazy to us, but most are far from it. We'll be talking about putting your life on the line for something important. We're talking about real risk. Hi, and welcome to the podcast. Wow, last week's episode featuring SAS Dr. Dan Pronk has gone off. A huge number of downloads, so thanks for listening, and thanks to Dan for being such a star. And today you're about to hear episode 7. I promised more and more interesting guests, and the lineup over the next few weeks really delivers on that. Stories of pain and suffering, courage, and maybe just a touch of madness should keep your ear glued to the speaker. Now, don't forget, I'm trying to grow my audience, so I've started a little giveaway. Each month I'll send a personalised copy of our book, Against All Odds, to someone who just flicks me an email comment. It doesn't have to be a favourable review, I'll just choose one randomly. The email's in the show notes, but it's admin@speleopix.com.au. I really want your feedback on how I can make this better. So let me know. Also, if you can think of a guest you'd like to hear interviewed. Now, today's guest, another amazing South Australian, Tim Jarvis, AM, was an environmental scientist, and he's now a leader in the field of climate change. He received his Order of Australia in 2010 for service to conservation and the environment, amongst other things. He was the Australian Geographic Adventurer of the Year in 2013 and Conservationist of the Year in 2016. But globally, he became famous when he recreated the extraordinary and perilous journeys on Mawson's Australasian Antarctic Expedition of 1912, and then Ernest Shackleton's life-saving small boat journey in 1916. And both these trips were done in period dress with equipment as original as possible. Jarvis's expeditions make incredible reading in the subsequent books that he wrote and are now the subject of two stunning documentaries. Tim, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thanks, Richard.
South Australia has done pretty well. I think it punches almost above its weight in terms of great scientists and explorers. And to drop a few names for you, Howard Florey, one of the co-inventors or discoverers of penicillin. Reg Sprigg, one of my personal heroes, the geologist who discovered the Ediacaran fossils and did a lot of inland exploration, I guess. Douglas Mawson, a man who means a great deal to you, obviously, a polar explorer. And my other personal hero, Sir Hubert Wilkins, and maybe we'll get around to having a chat about Hubert at some stage. But maybe we can add the name Tim Jarvis to that list. And can we claim you as our own, Tim?
Well, if they'll have me. I've been here 23 years, so I don't know if I qualify yet. Do I qualify?
I think 23 years is pretty good. Yeah. But where did you come from? Where did you start out?
Well, I'm a sort of universally confused person. I was born in the UK, grew up in Asia as a kid, went back to university in the UK, and then came here in 97 to work as a scientist for the Murray-Darling Basin Commission, and have lived everywhere really in between, and am determined that my kids will have a more sedentary life, or at least a place they can call home, and it's Adelaide.
But actually moving around so much gives us a young person a lot of opportunity for excitement and adventure, I presume.
Oh, look, it does. And when I moved to Malaysia as a seven-year-old in 1973, giving away my age, my parents would just say, you know, off you go and entertain yourself. And Malaysia in those days was, you know, wild dogs and snakes and jungle and monkeys. And it was a fantastic place to go and find yourself. And I've been on that journey ever since, I think.
Were you always living inland, or were you on boats?
We were on the outskirts of KL, and as I say, KL in the 70s is very different to the KL of today. In fact, the KL of today is almost unrecognisable, Kuala Lumpur. But I had no particular affinity with boats, but that was kind of forced upon me by the Shackleton expedition, where I had to learn fast.
As an adventurer, your background was in the mountains.
That's right. I mean, my background really started off in mountains, and then it became ice caps and suffering in cold places, which I've become known. And I've tended to use the same mountaineering skills to get me through those cold places, through crevasse fields and through dangerous or tricky terrain. use the same sort of techniques really for mountaineering that you use for polar expeditions, to a lesser extent for polar expeditions, but you still need those skills when you come to a gnarly problem, a bit like caving.
Tell us about your background in mountaineering. Where did that start and where did it take you?
Well, you know, it was unlikely in that it started in probably in Singapore, which doesn't have any mountains. Its highest one, I think, is 150 metres, Mount Faber, they call it, which is a kind of ramble. But I went to a school called United World College, and this was a Kurt Hahn school. He was the guy who started up the Duke of Edinburgh scheme. So the school was all about getting out there and doing things in the outdoors and a whole range of other things too. Social giving and environmentalism were all part of the curriculum way back in the 70s, which is quite something. But they had a very active outdoor scene there, very active mountaineering club, and people were sort of expected to get out there and give it a try. And of course I did, and I loved it. And so I began there.
So that sounds a little bit formative for you, because all those boxes that you ticked with that schooling, you've carried on with.
It's a lucky thing. You know, I went back to the 30th anniversary, however many years ago that was, of my time there, and to give a talk. And they read out a message from the patron of the school. I think it was Queen Noor of Jordan at the time, because it's become a big network of schools. You know, you entertain this idea in your mind that you're something of an original. And then with her one-page message to the assembled people, she essentially described the characteristics that pretty much I've found emerging in my life that really were evidently part of the school's philosophy that I really took to heart and been living ever since. This environmentalism and leadership and outdoors and trying to meld the three together into something that's compelling.
Do you remember the school motto?
I don't know if there was a motto actually, but I should.
Climb every mountain, yeah, ford every mountain.
Yeah, that's right.
Tim, can you tell me about your early days in mountaineering?
Well, I did a lot of stuff in the UK, a bit of stuff in Norway, some in the Alps. Now I have a brother-in-law who lives in Chile, so I go to the Andes a lot and climb there. And, of course, retracing Shackleton's journey involves a mountain crossing. It's not technical mountaineering going up, but the descending is very dangerous. And as most climbers will tell you, the going up is one thing. It's coming down that's the more dangerous bit. You know, you're off balance, the adrenaline rush of having made the summit is long gone, and you're now just trying to hurry home, and many accidents happen in that situation. So I've climbed all over the place, but I probably prefer expeditions that are not just mountain climbing expeditions. I prefer where there's a mixed skill set that you need to make it all happen. With Shackleton, it was learning to be a half-decent sailor amongst a group of people who are far better than me, followed by sections of technical mountaineering sort of terrain, mountainous terrain, particularly the descents and the crevasses and things like that, and ice travel, which is something I'm very accustomed to. So I try and combine it all. But it started off in the Alps and in the UK.
Any near misses or bad experiences in the mountains early on?
Yes, I've had a few interesting experiences. No major falls, thankfully, but, you know, maybe to have one or two more small falls might have been good for my confidence, ironically. You know, I think if you have the odd small mishap, it helps you redefine your boundaries a little bit more. And then since kids have come along, I've tried to err away a little bit from anything too technical, although having said that, my current project does involve climbing mountains at the equator, and there are four or five of those which are very tricky.
Your quest to explore and recreate famous expeditions to the polar regions, to me, Tim, seemed like an exercise in misery, endurance and hardship. And I hope this conversation will gain some insights into what sustains you and motivates you. And do you think stubbornness is the number one characteristic that allows people to do something like that?
I am a stubborn person. There's no question about that. So maybe it's as simple as that. Although I suspect it's also to do with how you frame things. I mean, I frame suffering as something that I, as part of learning a little bit more about who I am, I enjoy pushing myself. People say, why do you do it? I think, you know, if you think of life as being something where you're in a nice place, and to do something that's risky or hard leaves you in a deficit, in a negative situation, then that's one way of looking at things. I tend to feel that I'm gaining something by pushing myself and learning more. And that brings me up to parity, or maybe hopefully to a positive place. I think life is really all about pushing yourself and learning new things, because we're all fascinated to know a little bit more about what life is and what our place is in it, what the significance of it is. And that can happen in lots of different disciplines, of course. It can happen in medical research or the arts, or climbing mountains, or crossing ice caps, or caving. You know, you're out there just striving to find a bit more. And so I don't look at it as risky or hard. I look at it as something that's a privilege to be able to do, some level.
I mean, you're best known, I think, for the recreation of these two very famous expeditions, one where Mawson, primarily a scientific as well as an expedition of discovery across the ice cap of and the continent of Antarctica, and the second one by Shackleton, Ernest Shackleton, who was on initially a voyage of discovery but turned out to be a voyage of survival to rescue both himself and his men. I've sensed that part of your quest has been to defend these men, or to at least better understand them and their expeditions. Is that a fair conclusion?
Well, it didn't start off that way. It started off, I mean, probably a bit like you with your famous cave rescue, which was fantastic, if I can say so. You know, you've had, you know, 20 or 30 years of caving, but people will remember you, of course, for that incredible achievement. And maybe it eclipses everything else that you do, rightly or wrongly. And I tend to find the same with this. I've done two expeditions the old way, and of course people tend to forget all the other stuff that you've done. But I've done a lot of stuff in the lead-up to Mawson, and I remember at the time thinking, you know, there were some very dark moments on many of the expeditions where you're really, really fighting hard to hold it together mentally and physically in whatever situation, and thinking to myself, you know, what would it have been like for those people in the heroic era of polar exploration with their, you know, gabardine outfits and woolens and reindeer skin sleeping bags, the gear a lot heavier, the food a lot less palatable, no backup, no comms, really going out there for the first time. And so for me, it felt like an extension of the journey to try it the way that they did it, as close as one can. And Douglas Mawson was this heroic figure who happened to be from Adelaide, where, of course, I found myself. Interestingly, our birthdays are only a day or two apart, albeit many years apart. He was from Yorkshire, I was from Lancashire, other side of the Pennines. We both came here to work as scientists and both ended up at Adelaide University. So there was a bit of synchronicity there. Both 6'4", and I thought, you know, let's try that journey. In fact, there were people saying, you know, you should really look to do it, because the jury's out on as to whether he might have needed to cannibalize the second man that he found himself with, poor old Xavier Mertz. Why don't you do the trip and try and shed some light on those events all those years ago? So it became something. It started off as something very personal. It became about defending his honour.
So tell us what Mawson was planning and what he was hoping to achieve on his expedition.
Well, his expedition, he went down to essentially map a large part of Antarctica that was just completely uncharted. So the trip was actually along the coast, which I say actually along the coast. The coast of Antarctica is the most dangerous bit, because, of course, all the glaciers are tumbling down into the ocean there, and you've got a lot of crevasses, and it's a really dynamic, dangerous environment in which to travel. And he was on what they called the Far Eastern Sledging Party journey. He knew at the time it was the most risky, so he said, look, I will take the lead with that one. And he took two very capable people with him, Belgrave Ninnis, who was a British Army officer, young guy, very fit, and Xavier Mertz, who was a doctor but also the Swiss ski champion. So they thought, well, he can handle cold conditions. And off they went, and of course, events unfolded badly. You know, Ninnis fell in a crevasse that claimed him and the dog team and most of the food. And then from that point on, Mertz and Mawson were in survival mode, just trying to get home with the 20% of the food that they had left. And of course, Mertz didn't make it back either, and Mawson was the sole survivor, and it was the most amazing journey.
And Mawson, I believe, had about 100 miles to cover on his own with limited food and resources, and really didn't, the maths didn't quite add up that he would make it, I guess, in his mind.
You know, he was a scientist first and foremost. He never really saw himself as an explorer. He always insisted on being regarded as a scientist, and he was a wonderful at what he did. But being a scientist, he ran the numbers and thought, you know, this doesn't, as you say, add up. You know, I've got 520 Ks to cover with Mertz. Can we make it? Mertz dies 360 Ks into that return journey, and suddenly he's got 160 Ks to go on his own. And the odds were not good. You know, he just didn't feel that he had enough food to make it. He knew it was going to be desperate. He probably lost 40 kilos in body weight, but he made it, you know, just through sheer willpower.
I watched the documentary that you made subsequently. It looked like you lost just about 40 kilos as well.
Well, apparently I lost 32 kilos, actually. But I tell you what, it was very, very hard because, you know, with all that weight loss goes your ability to keep warm, your blood sugar levels through the floor. So you've got no capacity to think logically a lot of the time. You're mentally fatigued. You find it difficult to keep positive. It's a sort of triple whammy of things that come and visit when you're so debilitated and you've got so little food. I mean, I finish my food by 10 a.m. most days, and you have to endure the whole day of pulling the sled just to get to the tent in the evening on your own and have a, you know, a boiled sweet and reuse the tea bag. You know, it wasn't much fun.
Looking back at the Mawson expedition, Mert starts to deteriorate and loses consciousness, and Mawson stays in the tent with him until he dies, and then for a little time afterwards. That must have been a very lonely moment when he realised he had to, you know, gather his wits and move on. But I guess he perhaps succeeded because he then had doubled the rations for the last part of the trip.
Well, you know, ironically, you know, Mertz died just in time, if you want to look at it in those terms. Had he struggled on longer, he would have used up all of Mawson's available energy to physically pull him, because at this stage he wasn't walking. All the dogs had been consumed, initially fed to one another and then consumed by the men. And of course he was having to share the rations, even though he was giving him the soft bits of the animals. Mawson was eating the paws and the brains and the sinewy sort of meat, and he was saving the best stuff, the offal, for poor old Mertz, and inadvertently in the process killing him by poisoning him with the vitaminosis that Mertz undoubtedly experienced. But yeah, I mean, he died just in time, really, for Mawson to make it, I think. Had he gone on any longer, another few days, it probably wouldn't have had the same outcome.
Yeah, as a medical doctor, not that I know a great deal about vitamin A poisoning, but I understand that was probably the culprit, the vitamin A in the dog's livers in particular.
I think so. You know, we did everything the same. Sled weights. You know, the guys in that Edwardian period, the heroic era, they weren't always good at expressing deep emotion, or, you know, if I can say so without being disrespectful, even any great insights. A lot of their diaries are quite kind of perfunctory. They were sort of, you know, wind blew for the northeast at 15 miles an hour, temperature minus 25, ate a biscuit, kept going, you know, that sort of stuff. On the one hand, it doesn't give you many insights. On the other hand, it does allow you to specifically replicate exactly what they had, because they itemized that stuff very specifically. So we did everything the same apart from eat dogs. And I lost all the weight. The guy I was with lost a lot of weight. We found the friction of pulling the sled when it was a full-size Nansen sled, which is the big sleds the dogs pull. The friction was just made it impossible to pull. We had to cut it in half, just like Mawson did, to reduce the friction. But we didn't lose rafts of skin off the bottom of our feet, even though the temperatures we experienced were very similar, the dampness, the lack of food. I can only conclude that it was, you know, the vitaminosis that really ultimately made the difference.
Do you think with both the trips we're going to discuss, that the time that these guys were exposed to the food, the conditions, the clothing that they were wearing before the critical point in time arises, do you think that contributes at all to their state of disrepair at the point that you kind of step in to recreate things?
Look, it does. The science isn't perfect. You can't go to the Antarctic and go off and do the journey that Mawson and Ninnis and Mertz originally intended to do and retrace your steps to the point where the accident happened and then start living the way they did. You just frankly don't have the window of time to do it. So you're definitely turning up in physically better shape than they were. But equally, people in the modern era have different exercise regimes, and a lot of the polar expeditions at the time, the guys would just turn up and get fit on the job, you know, by pulling the sled, and the first couple of weeks would be toil and then they'd get into their stride. Having said that, you know, they were more psychologically prepared, they were more acclimatized, they knew one another's way a lot more, they'd spend a long time out on the ice, And, you know, you're literally coming from a position of safety to suddenly one of danger. And it's like going cold turkey. You just go straight from the warmth of a modern environment to depriving yourself of all the modern equipment and turning the clock back and going straight onto a starvation ration from scratch. And there's no warm up to that. So it's not perfect science to compare one with the other, but it's as close as you can get.
Oh, I'm completely in admiration of the way you would endure such things to prove a point in a way and to support the theory that Mawson did this without having to cannibalise Mertz, which is the kind of elephant in the room here. That's what some of the controversial historians have suggested, that perhaps it was impossible without doing that. So you felt that you could walk away with and be able to support the fact that didn't happen?
Yeah. I would say so. The one proviso I'd make there, I mean, I'm confident in my own mind that he could have done it. I think he was sufficiently single-minded and he had an ability to look at things very scientifically. It was a numbers game. If he wanted to get back to tell the story of what had happened and to feel that the other guys had not lost their lives in vain and that the results of their exploration were known and all that kind of thing, that he needed to make it. And in order to do that, he needed to ensure he had enough calories to make it happen. So I think he had enough of a sort of scientific single-mindedness that he could have done it. I did it without the need to, but the one proviso I would make is that, you know, day 30 on the return journey, where you're lying there in the tent and the blizzard is blowing and you're lying there with the cadaver of Mertz who'd accompanied you through all of these incredible life experiences and to whom you felt you owed so much, and then you've got the loneliness of the polar plateau that even the dead form of a friend lying there next to you represents company of some kind, to have to make the decision there and then that you were just going to leave any of the calories that his body might have provided behind and head off was not a situation I found myself in. I measured my effort knowing that I was measuring my effort. He didn't know how long his journey was going to take. He had to make a decision there and then whether he took any of his flesh or not. He couldn't afford to discover in 3 weeks' time that it was a mistake that he didn't. So the question is whether you need to take some of that flesh, but then find you don't have the subsequent need to use it and commit the ultimate.
Yeah, I think it would have been wise to maybe take a leg or just something to carry on with. I mean, frankly, I wouldn't have judged him harshly for doing that. I think that perhaps would have been the smart move. Why these historians have implied that would have been an appalling thing to do in that situation, I don't actually understand that, because, you know, history has judged people like the Andes plane crash survivors quite well, I think. You know, they did what they had to do and they showed a rare form of courage in doing that.
That's right. I mean, I think it's very easy. Hindsight is a wonderful thing. I mean, you look at people who dissect the decisions that Scott made that ultimately resulted in all of them dying, but, you know, each one of them was a small decision that happened to have been the wrong decision with the benefit of hindsight. But you didn't know that at the time, and cumulatively those effects, you know, escalated and resulted in them all dying. And with Mawson, you can look back and you can question these things and you can question the motives and you can apply your modern morals as someone who's perhaps living in a developed country in the 21st century, and they just don't apply to the circumstances in which those guys found themselves. Very, very different. But I don't think he did it. I feel that he could have done it without the need to, and I've got nothing but respect for what he went through physically. I mean, it was just remarkable that he managed to keep going.
How old was Mawson at that stage?
That's a good question. With the passage of time, I can't remember now, but I mean, when I did that trip, he was in his 30s when he did that trip. I was in my 40s, albeit pretty fit. Less fit after that trip, I can tell you. But he was about 10 years younger than me when he did it. And the photographs that we are accustomed to seeing of him, the balaclava-clad face on the old $100 bill and the stamps are, in fact, photographs taken when he was 10 or 15 years older on his Banzari expeditions in the early 30s. So he was a pretty young man, relatively.
So you feel he warrants his place on the $100?
Oh, certainly. Note? I mean, he was remarkable in so many ways, and a great academic, and, you know, he was quite entrepreneurial. And he was even responsible for setting up something called the South Australian Forest League, which is essentially 1920 looking at reforestation as something that we should actively Dude, that's 100 years ago. We could do with some of that today, I think.
On a personal note for you doing these expeditions, have you been married throughout these last couple of big trips?
I went on the Mawson trip and I thought I should propose to Liz when I got back. So that was good thinking time. We'd known one another since we were kids in Malaysia, and so she'd known what I'd been up to, but I wasn't married at that stage. I proposed to her when I got back from that trip. And then she had to suffer through the Shackleton expedition.
You're listening to Real Risk, the adventure podcast with Richard Harris.
I've just reread, so I could catch up again on events, the book called Epic, the story of Shackleton's incredible small boat and then mountain journey. As someone who's prepared and performed expeditions myself, I actually found the first half of the book the most stressful and difficult to read, because the preparation that goes into something on this scale and the toll that takes on you and a relationship is enormous.
Yeah, I mean, it was really pretty brutal, the whole thing. I mean, it took 4 years. I was going back a step. I was asked by Serena Shackleton's granddaughter if I would lead the team to recreate his expedition where his ship sank and he famously saved everyone from certain death down in the Antarctic. And of course I said yes. And it's easy to say yes. And in fact, the more publicly you say yes, the less opportunity you have to back out, which is quite a good technique in itself. But that began the process of many, many years of tortuous planning. And I think with expeditions, the key thing is getting to the start line in good enough mental and physical shape to actually do the trip itself. Because certainly the planning of that one was pretty desperate. A lot of moving parts. Everything that could go wrong did go wrong. And even the backups and the backups for the backups, they went wrong too. And you're constantly trying to problem solve just to get through them. So good preparation for the trip itself.
And the problems didn't really stop just once you're on the trip. You know, the political and organisational issues continued.
Well, they did. And I mean, we had a... it's almost too painful to recount, but I mean, we had so many things go wrong that when we finally started the expedition, I remember thinking at least we're up against just a completely impartial adversary in the form of nature, you know, whereas prior to that, there'd been a lot of politics and money issues and logistics and problems of that nature. When you get down there and you get in a small keelless rowboat, you try and go across the Southern Ocean wearing, you know, woolens with no guy lines or EPIRBs or life jackets and things like that, it feels like a much more honest endeavour. But that too was challenging, very challenging.
I can highly recommend everyone reads the book Epic, because the external human forces that come into play, even when they're floating around in the Southern Ocean in their little boat, are completely treacherous compared to some of the natural forces at work. It's a really interesting part of the story. I remember as a child we used to play that game, would you rather be burned or would you rather be drowned? And I'm thinking about your two period type expeditions, where one you're dragging a sled for hundreds of kilometres across the ice with the risk of falling down crevasses, and you're on a starvation diet and you're freezing cold, you're sleeping at night in a reindeer sleeping bag which gets wet after being in there for a few hours because of the condensation and is frozen solid when you try and unroll it at the start of the evening, comparing that kind of torture to my worst nightmare, being cold and wet and add seasickness on top of that and occasional buckets of freezing cold water pouring down your back. Which would you prefer as a recommended pastime, Tim?
Oh, look, I think this is coming from a caver. You're always cold and wet. I think, you come from a mountaineering background. You're used to bad weather and hunkering down on the ocean. To state the obvious, when the weather comes in, there's nowhere to hide because everything above you is moving and everything below you is moving. And that makes it very, very challenging. And add to the fact that with Shackleton, you've still got five other people that are forming part of this team, albeit very accomplished guys. I still get on very well with all of them. But you've got the man management issues, the leadership issues, the self-doubt that creeps in. You can't show it. You're in very, very close proximity to people. You're in the space the size of a queen-size double bed, as I say in the book. You know, we're all sitting there looking at one another and people can read your inner thoughts and you're trying to maintain a focus. I think life at sea in a replica of the James Caird, Shackleton's Little Boat, where you're trying to show leadership to a team of really high-performing people is harder than suffering on your own pulling a sled, where you've just got to take one step after the next. And there's a lot of soul-searching goes on, but at least you can kind of let your guard down at times, and it's just you that you have to answer to, whereas you've got five people with you, you have to set an example. And it was very challenging.
Yeah, so it will give a vote to cold, wet, and seasick being the worst of the two.
I think so, you discover all sorts of interesting stuff about it. We had to do every sea survival training course that was going to get insurance and all the stuff one has to do an expedition in the modern era these days to enable you to make a film and write a book. And one of the interesting things is survival time at sea and how quickly you will go if you do fall over the edge. There's no neoprene underneath your cotton smocks and woolens and leather boots and no guy lines. And ocean temperature down there is about 1 degree Celsius, sometimes even cold, sometimes below freezing, but because it's saline, obviously it remains kind of water. And your survival time is sub 10 minutes. And you die really because you cease to be able to kick anymore and keep yourself above water, and down you go. And I think death would be very, very, very quick. And we all knew that. We discussed these things at great length before we went, because a key aspect of getting an expedition like that done successfully is making sure everybody knows exactly what they're getting themselves into, so that you don't get out in the middle of the Southern Ocean and someone goes, oh, this is what you meant when you said it was going to be cold or the seas are going to be large. Everybody knows in advance and they've come to terms with it.
And did it still come as a surprise?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I remember thinking, yeah, okay, so this is what a storm on the Southern Ocean feels like in a 23-foot keelless rowboat. Not much fun. And, you're on the helm of a boat as a non-sailor, really, having trained hard to... I mean, I did plenty of twilight sailing and the Lincoln race and things like that, but it's not quite the same when you're on the keel of a boat in a big sea state at night and you can't see anything. And the boat only sits 40 centimetres above the surface of the sea, the decks, because of all the weight of people and ballast you put in there to try and stop the thing capsizing in the absence of a keel. And first thing you know about a wave is it crashes over you from the side, or you feel a sense of weightlessness as the boat gets picked up and off she goes down the face of a large wave, and you can't really see it until you see breaking water ahead of you. And then you reach the trough, and then you've got to hope that the boat picks itself up and gets over the next one before the next wave comes over you from behind. So it's a frightening environment, I have to say.
So how many days were you in the boat for?
Well, we're only out there for 2 weeks, but it was a long 2 weeks in the context of the trips I normally do, which are often much, much longer. I mean, the bid to cross Antarctica was about an 80-day trip. Most of them are sort of north of 40 or 50 days. So in the context of that, a couple of weeks at sea doesn't seem like much. But when you're worried the whole time at a heightened level of concern about what might happen, it's a long time. It's a long time. An hour shift on the helm is a long time, as are the 5 hours down below deck when you're sitting in your wet clothes waiting for the next turn to go up on deck. So only 2 weeks, but a long 2 weeks.
Part of the story which makes Shackleton's team so heroic and accomplished is the celestial navigation that allows them to navigate north to from Elephant Island to South Georgia. And you experienced pretty similar conditions in terms of sun sightings or lack thereof, and managed to kind of replicate that part of it as well, which is extraordinary.
Look, it was just remarkable. And, you derive a certain enjoyment from that. You feel that there's a synchronicity going on there that's nothing to do with you, and it gives you an immense sense of satisfaction that you're doing it in the conditions they had. You wouldn't want nice starry nights and calm seas. You want a bit of rough weather, and you tell yourself that when you're in a storm. You say, this is what Shackleton had, this is what we want. But we saw the sun twice. We saw it day 4 and day 11, I think it was. And the key with that kind of celestial navigation is you've got to see the sun when it's at the high point in the sky for your latitude, so how far north or south you are on the planet. Any other time is no use. You've got to pretty much know where you are to know when to start looking for it, for it to be at the high point in the sky for your latitude. So there's a whole bunch of things that go into making those decisions. And even then, when you finally work it all out, you check it and check it and check it in, you only know how far north or south you are. You don't know how far east or west you are. And when you're trying to find South Georgia, that's also challenging. And that doubt eats away at you, and you've got to just keep resisting it. And the plan was just to get to the latitude that South Georgia is on and then turn right and try and follow 54 degrees south till we hit the island. Well, not literally.
I know you're a massive fan of Shackleton and his leadership style, and I have to say I've been re-inspired by reading your book again, because it talks so much about Shackleton and the way he led his men, and all sorts of cunning little tricks to keep them motivated and on top of the, you know, morale smashing problems that were constantly coming their way.
Very clever.
Yeah, there's an expression that I think Edmund Hillary said. He said, "For scientific research, there is Scott. For speed across the ice, there's Amundsen. But in times of trouble, pray God for Shackleton." You know, it was just he just had this capacity to put himself in other people's shoes. He had emotion, what we now call emotional intelligence, which I don't like as a term. But, you know, he'd grown up in Ireland of English descent, and so he was, or the other way around, he was Anglo-Irish. He had a family with a lot of sisters. His mother was a dominant force in his life. And so he, perhaps without sounding cliche, was a little bit more in touch with his emotions than your average male of the period. So he could understand people, and he knew how to get the best out of people. And I think that was the key, really, to his success.
In some ways, was that even bigger shoes to fill than just being the leader of an expedition?
Yeah, I mean, it's huge. I mean, you don't enter into it lightly. I was very honoured to be asked by his granddaughter to do this expedition. It's probably the biggest one in the Antarctic. Everybody knows the Shackleton story. You know, everybody's watching to make sure you don't make any missteps or be disrespectful, or that you're performance lives up to the standard that he set, and that's a very high standard. So one of the biggest risks of taking that on is there's no upside. You know, you can only, you know, if you do as well as he did, people will only regard that as acceptable, and that's incredible to get that, do that well. Do anything less than that and people will shoot you down.
Well, I imagine that Alexandra Shackleton's judgment of the expedition would have been the one you were most interested in.
I was really concerned about it. You know, we had some amazing moments in that she was going down to the Antarctic lecturing on a vessel at around about the time that we would be finishing our expedition. That's all we knew. We arrived, we did the expedition, we finished on this sub-Antarctic island of South Georgia. Weather came in. There were delays. We finally managed to get out. We got to a safe port down there, a place called Gritviken, which happens to be where Shackleton is buried. And who should arrive on the day we get there but her, on her ship. The weather was terrible. And then miraculously out of nowhere came a one-hour window of weather where she was able to jump on a Zodiac and come to shore. And I never forget seeing her coming across the waves like a figurehead on the prow of the boat, coming up and landing the Zodiac near his grave. And all of us went and just had a moment at the grave. She turned around, went back to the ship, and then the weather came in, you know, and it was just remarkable that that should happen of all the places, you know, to meet her. And she was thrilled. Yeah.
Yeah. That you mentioned at the start of this discussion how you felt some strong similarities between you and Mawson. You know, you'd both come to Australia as scientists, ended up in South Australia and so forth. But that expedition, you couldn't have followed his crew's steps more closely, and most of it wasn't by design. It just, the similarities in the events and the trajectory that you took were extraordinary.
I think the key to life generally and any big endeavour, certainly expeditions, is having an ability to look at anything that comes your way positively. So you've got to look at mishaps as opportunities to be overcome. Can your ingenuity still carry the day? That sort of thing. And you convince yourself that this is all part of the experience. You know, would somebody else fold? Can I continue on? The weather's bad. That's what they had, you know. But certainly we had eight of us arrived at South Georgia, six in our boat and two camera people who rendezvoused with us coming in on a completely different vessel. And in the end, that number was whittled down to the three of us who did the trip through injury and misadventure and one or two other things. And the three that did it were myself, the expedition leader, Barry Gray, who's a very good friend of mine, a very good climber, who was the sort of hard man of our expedition, and Paul Larson, the Melbourneian, who's a world-class sailor. And he was our navigator. And you look back to Shackleton's trip and it was him Frank Worsley, the navigator, and Tom Crean, the hard man of their expedition. So we did it as the three, just the same as them, even though the original intention was to do it as an eight. And so you've got to love that wonderful synchronicity that allows that to happen, although at the time it was challenging again.
Mawson went down south primarily, I think, for reasons of science and exploration, whereas Shackleton, it seems a little bit less clear why he was going down there, and it seemed like more of a personal calling. In fact, when he was asked that, one of the quotes that that describes him says, he said, it's an indescribable calling. Do you think that's what most modern adventurers and explorers, do you think that's what their motivation is? It's something that's very hard to define. It's just something inside.
I think so. I mean, I think there are different motivations. I mean, I think that there's this sort of spirit of adventure in people, and it drives a lot of human endeavor because we're here for a relatively short time, assuming it's just one go that we get. You know, you're always trying to find out a little bit more about what it's all about. And that can involve, as I've said, it can involve scientific research or the arts or astronomy or climbing mountains or diving in caves. You know, you're trying to find out a little bit more about what's out there. What emerges from you when you put yourself in these difficult situations? Will it reveal something to you about yourself or your relationship with this place that maybe tells you something? And it's not something you have as an actual conversation every day, but I think it's a driver in all this. You know, you're searching for something. You're searching for the experience. That's really what motivates me. I mean, others do it for a range of reasons. So I now use the expeditions as a way to talk about environmental issues in a way that, you know, if I went in as an environmental scientist, you'd get short shrift. But if you're an adventurer and you can talk about leadership, sometimes you get to talk to people you might not otherwise have the opportunity to talk to. So it's a good way in. Others do it for ego. I think Shackleton did it. He wanted to live life on a big stage. You know, he was really intrigued in what it was all about. You know, he loved people. It's why he went back again in 1922 and died. Doubt he didn't intend to, but he died the night he got back to South Georgia, which was the scene of his greatest victory, only 6 years after that great victory. You know, one more roll of the dice to see what happened. And most of the guys who were on the original expedition went with him again.
Yeah, I think that's an exceptional case for the fact that he was an extraordinary leader when the worst time of their lives is something that half the team relished the thought of returning
to. They all remembered it, you know, and Shackleton had returned to the war. They all had. In fact, Timothy McCarthy, who was one of the six guys with Shackleton on the James Caird, the small boat, he got back after all of the things they went through and enlisted immediately in the Navy and was lost at sea only a month after getting back, after 3 years of suffering down in the Antarctic. Lost at sea, a German raider torpedoed his ship off the coast of Ireland. But for them, it was this great adventure. It was life. And as I say, it was how they framed things. Who wants a normal life when you can do something exceptional? And that's the way they tended to view it. And they were desperate to get back down there and continue it.
There's some fantastic messages, which I know you include as part of your public speaking. I presume you talk to a lot of young people as well as the corporate sector. And to use your exploration and adventures as a kind of tool or a weapon to get people thinking about the environment is obviously a fantastic bridge to that message. But the leadership stuff around Shackleton, I know a lot of the corporate sector looks for inspiration and leadership messages. And one of the great terms I've heard about his leadership technique was to pivot and shift. In other words, when something goes bad, and just as you've described, you say, right, here's an opportunity, not a disaster. You pivot on that and shift focus so that when, for example, the Endurance, the ship they were on, finally succumbed to the crushing ice and disappeared below the waves, he pretty much put the kettle on and said, right, let's go home. Let's make that our new target. That's extraordinary.
You know, he was just incredibly incredibly adaptable. And this is a skill set that we need so urgently, really, in the world in which we find ourselves today, particularly in a COVID world. You're constantly having to adapt to still get outcomes achieved when this new normal is very, very different to what we used to. He was constantly thinking, you know, is the goal I set out to achieve still achievable? If so, are the things I'm doing best place to get that job done? If they're not, he would discard them and choose a different way of doing them and do that constantly, constant reevaluation. And in the event of, you know, in their case, when the ship goes down and very evidently the opportunity to cross Antarctica on foot is no longer viable. He just pursues the new goal with the same conviction as the old one, as if nothing has happened, you know, and he sells himself and everybody with him the same inspirational messages that make them feel as though this will be a tremendous success if they can return intact. You know, many would have thought, wow, you know, we've missed out on the goal of crossing Antarctica. We're financially ruined. People will laugh at us when we return. We'll come back with our tails between our legs. That's not a way to begin a new bid to save yourselves. He sold it to them as something truly inspiring, a sort of Henry V style thing. You know, imagine if we can pull this off. Think of how people will view us. We'll be heroes when we return against all the odds. And they all bought into it.
Yeah, he turned a disaster into a story of heroism and derring do.
And, you know, I think that what he achieved by saving them all was a far greater achievement than crossing Antarctica would have been had they managed to do it.
Now, no one's better placed than you are to look at climate change in the polar regions and to look at historical photographs and evidence and then to look at the real-time images that you see. Can you use that to convince people that this is a real problem?
Well, you can. I think the... The thing about using the polar regions as a way to try and convince people that climate change is real is that I think people are a little bit accustomed to seeing melting ice, and it perhaps doesn't have the impact that it used to. That's the first thing I'd say. You know, the second thing is that the scale of what you're dealing with in somewhere like the Antarctica is so vast, it's actually quite difficult to point to something and give someone a visual cue. Antarctica is twice the size of Australia, and its average ice thickness is 2,050 metres, so this is a huge... So even if that ice reduced by half, it's difficult to show how the levels have moved up and down. Where it's easier to do it is at places like the equator, where my current project involves climbing mountains which have a glacier, and those glaciers have retreated back up the valley, and you can see the retreat of the glaciers much more clearly than you can see the Antarctic ice going down. But with all of those, that's just the beginning of the conversation. You then have to use that hook of how you've started the conversation, maybe with someone who's skeptical, as a means to then say, okay, what can their role be in doing something about this? Because nothing worse than getting to an end of a motivational talk and someone going, he never told me what I could do to be part of the solution. I've just been presented with this overwhelming problem and now I'm depressed. So it's important to relate it back to what individuals can do.
Well, that's a good message. Now, have you given any thought to Sir Hubert Wilkins and going down the same path with him? I think his aeroplane journey from Norway to Alaska, I think it was, where he was pretty much dead reckoning the whole way, relying on celestial navigation, taking his mittens off in the rear cockpit to use the sextant while the other pilot was flying. That's the most extraordinary feat of navigation and survival in itself. How does that appeal to you?
Oh, he's amazing. I was down at Deception Island in Antarctica, which is, in addition to being an active volcano, it's one of two. There's that one in Erebus on the far side of Antarctica. And, of course, Wilkins landed down there on a little kind of lava airstrip, you know, thousands of miles from anywhere. You know, he found it and landed and resupplied and off he went again, you know. An amazing guy that has never been given really the credibility he deserves. I think there's one heroic South Australian polar figure who's, through no intention of his own, but he's just got the limelight, and that's Douglas Mawson, whereas I think Rymel and certainly Hubert Wilkins really deserve a lot more than they get.
Yeah, I think part of Wilkins' problems was he was described as aggressively modest, and he didn't really... whereas I think Mawson was much better at self-promotion and, you know, a very necessary thing to organise expeditions, as you well know. You have to raise funds, and you have to do that. You have to stick your head above the parapet.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. I think, you know, Wilkins is one of those people you look back on, and again, he's one of these polymaths. He's, you know, good at everything. You know, he's a good at international, you know, relations and flying around. He's like Nansen. You know, founder of the United Nations and multilingual and a good swordsman and, you know, Wilkins, fantastic pilot.
Amazing submariner, guy. Photographer.
Submariner, yeah.
Out there with Hurley.
You know, buys a submarine off the US Navy for a dollar and sails it across the Atlantic and gets to Spitsbergen and says, right, we're going to go underneath the ice of the Arctic and prove that there's, you know, no land under there. It's just ocean. Someone sabotaged the dive planes on that. I don't think they shared his optimism.
No, I think there was a little bit of mutiny going on by then. They were all a bit concerned for their lives, and rightly so. But he was certainly an enthusiast.
He was.
Yeah.
Amazing guy.
Well, Tim, it's been an absolute pleasure to chat with you. I'll just leave you with one final question. If we could have a dinner party and we could invite either Mawson or Shackleton, who would we have?
Ooh.
Or do you not want to pick a favourite?
I wouldn't want to pick. I wouldn't want to offend anyone. But I think depends if you wanted to get a word in yourself. If you wanted to have a chance, you probably get Mawson, who is a little bit more reserved. If you wanted to play second fiddle, but have a good time, you'd invite Shackleton, I think.
That sounds like a great problem to ponder. So thanks again, Tim. Thanks for coming.
Yeah, thanks.
That's it for this episode of Real Risk. If you're a risk taker or know someone who'd be good for the show, please send me an email on admin@speleopix.com.au. I'd love to hear from you. Let me know what you think of the podcast. Subscribe, give me a rating, but most importantly, join me for the next one. We'll see you again on Real Risk.